Welcome to Jewish History with Rabbi David Katz, connecting the human side to Jewish history. For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidavidkatz.com.
Hi, I have a treat for you. The truth is, I don't have time to give a original rendering tonight on yard sites. There aren't so many to talk about, but I'm going to cut through all that and tell you I have a paper here I gave in school and college about a year ago at a conference we had about Cheirims, people from around the world, and this one has to do with what they call the Get of Vienna, which you probably never heard of. It's very famous, but like a lot of halachic issues, they're famous, nobody ever heard of it. And not the Get of Cleves, how Get Me Vina. And it involves someone whose yard site is coming up in a few days. That's the Maram. I'm talking about the Maram Lublin, and that's the Maram in the back of the Gemara underneath the Marsha for you yeshiva types. Here we're dealing with a rabbi from the golden age of Jewish Poland, Mamish in the middle of it. I spoke about this, about the Kleoker lived at that time when the Jews had it good in Poland way back in the 15 and early 1600s. But I'm going to skip all that and cut right to my talks. I'm going to be reading you from a paper I delivered. And as I said, it was a conference on the different types of cherem out there. So that's what I emphasize over here. And you'll see how the Maram, whose yard sale is coming up very soon, by Mayor Ben Gedalia of Lublin, probably doesn't mean anything to you, but he's a famous person, how he plays a very important role in this. Here we go. The story takes place in 1611. A marriage was entered into by two young teenagers from wealthy families, which was a common practice, Yitzchak Walfish of Lvov and Batsheva Bas Feibish of Prague and Vienna. The couple apparently lived with the bride's family in Vienna. At the age of 16, this is the summer of 1611, Yitzchak became ill, and they feared he might die. That's the young husband. Since the young husband couple didn't have any kids, the wife would become a Yavama, a childless widow who could not remarry until she obtained the necessary release, the chalitza, from a brother of the dead husband. Said brother might not issue such a release, leaving Batsheva an aguna. Ordinarily, in pre-modern traditional Ashkenazic middle-class circles, at the time of a wedding, the brothers of a groom would hand the bride a shtar chalitza, a document committing themselves under penalty of cherem, to release the new wife without making any difficulties should such tragic circumstances occur. But for whatever reason, no such shtar chalitza had been written at the time of this young couple's wedding. Accordingly, Batsheva's family went into a panic, determined to forestall Batsheva's becoming a possible aguna. Being a wealthy, elite family, they approached a family friend in Vienna, a prominent visiting rabbi, who happened to be from Lvov, although he wasn't the chief rabbi there, the Abbezin, to try to secure a get from the deathly ill young husband, because as a divorcee, Batsheva would be free to remarry without having to undergo chalitza. This rabbi, Yeshua Falcon, was a prominent person indeed. He was a wealthy and highly regarded Rosh Yeshiva in Lvov, and a leading rabbinic presence on the Vadar Barotzes. Rabbi Cohn was particularly famous as an expert in halacha. After his death, Rabbi Cohn's commentaries on the Torah Shulchan Aruch, particularly his seminal commentary on Choshen Mishpat, would enshrine him in the rabbinic pantheon as the Sma and the Prisha Drisha. It clearly seemed to Batsheva's family that if a divorce was executed under the supervision of one of the leading rabbinic experts of the day, the validity of the divorce would be unassailable. The situation of an extremely ill husband divorcing a beloved wife to spare her aguna problems is well known in the Talmud as Get Shchimera. Get Shchimera. It's a subject beloved by Talmudists, keen-witted Talmudists down the centuries, for the complex halachic issues it raises, like exactly when does the divorce go into effect, immediately before the death, from the moment the divorce was written, was it retroactive? How would retroactivity work with a dead person? Among the central questions raised in the Talmud and its literature was whether such a get was to be considered conditional. Unlike the usual situation, where a husband divorces his wife because of negative feelings, in the case of the get shchimra, the assumption is he's divorcing her because of his affectionate desire to spare her potential aguna problems after his death. So is the document being executed a conditional document? In other words, what if he doesn't die? What if he recovers? Are they divorced? Or was it taken for granted that if he didn't die, he never meant for the divorce to take effect? In the Talmud, there are legal arguments on both sides of the question, and a set of verbal formulas was suggested whereby the sick husband could stipulate that the divorce was not effective if he recovered. The problem is, the verbal formulas were quite complicated, and no consensus could be reached by the medieval rabbis over the legal effectiveness of some of these formulas. The result was socially undesirable. A sick husband may have issued a divorce that he regarded as conditional, but which his wife may regard as unconditional. In this case, we're not dealing with such an affectionate couple after all. Imagine such a woman who now wishes to remarry. Some rabbis say she may. Others say she may not. And that if she does, her children are mom's heir. It was such considerations that led influential Ashkenazic rabbis, one in the 13th century, Rabbi Yechiel of Paris, to institute a practice in his Beis Din, in his court, that a sick husband would not stipulate anything. He would divorce his wife, period, without any encumbering language. That way, there could be no questioning her status as no longer married to her husband. What about the husband's concern that if he recovers, she may not wish to remarry him? To address this concern, Rabbi Yechiel of Paris required that the couple, the wife really, should solemnly promise to remarry, to commit herself to remarry her former husband once he recovers. In this commitment ceremony, the wife formally declared that if she refused to remarry him, she would be subject to the Cherim HaKehilos, to be publicly stigmatized as an evil person in violation of Ashkenazic decrees prohibiting going back on one's promise to marry. This is stuff from 1,000 years ago. Being in Cherim was presumably highly undesirable, so it's assumed she would rather remarry her husband than be in that state. Now, my friends, this is really nothing new in Ashkenaz or in Europe for that matter. The Catholic Church, back in the 4th century at the Council of Elvira, enacted a kind of harem of its own for young men who promised to marry a girl and then reneged. Already in the 11th century, Ashkenazic Jews were recorded as doing the same thing. So when Rabbi Yechiel of Paris tailored his sanctions to fit the Get Shchimra scenario, he was merely adjusting an existing cultural legal template. The directive of Rabbi Yechiel of Paris was recorded in the Sefer Mordechai, which is in the back of the Gemara, halachic work of the 13th century that was very influential in Ashkenazic Jewry. The directive was included in the Shulchan Aruch by the Ramah in the section dealing with the laws concerning Get Shchimra. And although the Shulchan Aruch was by no means a universally accepted law code in 1611, but it was there. On the other hand, Rabbi Shua Falcon, who presided over the execution of the Get, was a leading Talmud of the Ramah himself, and instrumental in the code of the Ramah attaining authoritative status among 17th century Jewry. He wrote the commentaries that made the Ramah, the final word in Choshen Mishpat. I'm talking about the Sman, things like that. Okay, now what all this means is that Rabbi Cohn approached a 16-year-old husband, Yitzhak Wolfish, persuaded him to give his wife Bathsheba get without stipulating any conditions, as per the practice of Rabbi Yechiel of Paris. The young husband was assured by the rabbi and the relatives that he would not suffer by the transaction, and that once the divorce was executed, she, or her representatives anyway, would sign a document promising to remarry Yitzhak if he recovers, and that if she reneged, she would be subject to a Cherim HaKehilos and publicly stigmatized as such in the synagogues. The sick husband agreed. Two documents were executed in a public ceremony in which Team Yitzchak and Team Bathsheba committed to remarry within a month of Yitzchak's recovery, if he recovered. A point of contention later was the exact language of the documents, whether or not the specific cherem, the term cherem, was omitted. The document simply stating that if she reneged, she would pay Yitzchak a penalty payment of 2,000 zehuvim, a lot of money. On the other hand, the document did state that as a divorcee, she was entitled to her ksuba, which was 4,600 zehuvim. In other words, she gets from him double what she promised to give him. In other words, if Yitzchak demanded 2,000 from her for non-fulfillment, she could hit him for 4,600. It certainly did seem that the deathly ill 16-year-old husband from Lvov, alone, friendless, and lawyerless in his wife's community in Vienna, had been snookered. His wife was gone, and he had no legal way of getting her back, despite the solemn assurances that had been made to him at the time he agreed to the divorce. Now, if Yitzchak had succumbed to his illness, if he would have died, none of this would have mattered. As it turned out, Yitzchak had the bad taste to fully recover, whereupon he found himself without a wife, contrary to what he'd been assured. Of course, he also discovered that his wife was de facto not subject to any penalty for non-fulfillment. True, there had been a cherem, but a close reading, see, they did the lawyer stuff, revealed that it had been couched in unclear terms that could be disputed. And there was no financial penalty for Bathsheba, because her ksuva was double any penalty payment she owed him for non-fulfillment. So in other words, like I said before, you want to hit me for money? I hit you for double. As if to make matters worse, Yitzchak, the husband, who at that point very much wanted to remarry Bathsheba, was told that if he wanted to, he must start anew and write Tanoim, financial gifts and commitments to Bathsheba and her family. Without going through all the sordid details, the 16-year-old Yitzchak signed away his bank account and as much real estate in Lvov that was in his name, all in exchange for a promise by Bathsheba to marry him. After he signed everything away, she went and got engaged to another man. When Yitzchak protested, he was advised that if Bathsheba hit him with the ksuba, he would owe her a couple thousand. On the other hand, if he now signed a document waiving all claims, marital as well as financial, against Bathsheba, she would sign a waiver of all claims against Yitzchak. Both parties, unencumbered, would move on, though Yitzchak would now be broke. Well, not exactly. In return for signing his waiver, he would get 1,000 zehuvim, 1,000 gulden. Yitzchak agreed and signed, and the matter seemed ended, the young man having learned, presumably, some valuable lessons about life. Or so Bathsheba's family naively thought. Why naive? Although the get was executed in Vienna, it really was a Lvov affair, an episode in the long-running feud between two factions in Lvov. Lvov, or Lemberg, was one of the leading Jewish communities in the Polish Commonwealth. Lvov contained three large, independent, and well-heeled yeshivas, each headed by a famous scholar. I told you, this is back in the Golden Age of Poland. One yeshiva was headed by Rabbi Yeshua Kohn, a cousin and student of the Ramah, who had married one of the richest girls in Lvov. Rabbi Kohn's father-in-law single-handedly bankrolled a large yeshiva that was directed by Rabbi Kohn for decades. Rabbi Kohn proudly mentions this fact in his published works. Indeed, the projected name for his monumental commentary on the Torah and Shulchan Aruch was Beis Yisrael, because his father was a Beis Yisrael idol. Kohn was therefore a wealthy Rosh Yeshiva and a leading member of Vada Barotzos. At the time of the Get controversy, Rabbi Kohn had headed his yeshiva for more than 20 years. Now, back in 1595, remember the Get took place in 1611, in 1595, 5 years after Rabbi Kohn moved to Lvov and set up his yeshiva, another big scholar moved to Lvov and founded another, competing yeshiva. Sound familiar? This yeshiva was financed not by a father-in-law, but by a brother-in-law. The brother-in-law was Avraham Wolfish. None other than the father of the 16-year-old husband in our story. The scholar who headed the yeshiva was the Maharam Lublin, or Meir ben Gedalia, who was a world-class posek, one of the leading responsa writers of his day. He had shalas, if you read his shalas and tshuvas, he gets shalas from all over Europe. He had shalas from Turkey and the Middle East. He was also a charismatic Rosh Yeshiva with many famous students, and his notes on the Gemara are printed in the back of most Gemaras. In addition to all that, Rabbi Meir was notorious for being a difficult, quarrelsome, and combative person. He engaged in, that's whose yard sale were coming up. He engaged in numerous scholarly disputes and hurled insults at his colleagues right and left. My favorite one is when, in his tshuvas, he gets a shaila from Metz, and, you know, he gives an answer. By the way, a mekel answer. And the other rabbi said, well, I don't know. And he said, you challenge me? I want to read you what he writes in tshuva. Kvar ol al daiti legalis kolona barabim. I was going to expose you publicly as a poor scholar. L'harma mitznefes ha'tam erosho. And I was going to have you defrocked as a rabbi. I don't know how you do that. Poba base kinesis de kak lublin. Basifa zabarotsis. No, I was going to have you publicly busted. This is what he writes. This is the Maram Lublin. Achazarti machshapti zos. But I changed my mind. Listen to this. Pen yiulo lekovid. She'ish kamoni. Yitapel b'shuffle kamohu. But for a guy like you to be put in cherem by somebody like me is a covet for you. You're such a pachas and a garnish and a nothing. And I'm such a big deal that to go around like that famous story where the guy, you know, the Mashulk has that letter, get out of here, sign covet's kaim, you know. So for you to be put down by me is a covet for you, which shows you what a strong temper the Maram Lublin had. Anyway, I'm going to continue with my article. So he engaged in numerous quarrels. The reason Reb Meir came to Lvov was he was kicked out of Lublin because he engaged with bitter quarrels there with the head of another yeshiva there, Reb Shimon Wolf Auerbach. There are many stories along his line, but I'll skip them now. So in 1611, Lvov contained at least two large yeshivas, which were financially independent, headed by two renowned halachists, one of whom, Reb Meir ben Gedalia, did not respect the other, Reb Yeshua Kohn. So you have two competing yeshivas, probably, if I know Europe, a block or two away, and one's the Sma, and one is the Maram Lublin. Oh boy, oh boy. Anyway, that's how they did in those days. Now, so you see, there was also a third well-known yeshiva in Lvov that had been headed for decades by a third famous rabbi, Rabbi Noach Hendel ben Shmaria. Again, a renowned scholar and important member of the Vada Barotzes. This is what you call Chachmas Manoach, also a famous sefer. We do not know whether Maram Lublin had a good or bad relationship with Rabbi Noach. We do know he had a bad relationship with the Sma. One surmises that the Maram Lublin would not have gotten along with a competing Rosh Yeshiva, but I have not been able to ascertain this. Just to flesh out a perfect storm, about a year before this divorce, that was the year before 1611, Rabbi Noach left Lvov to become the chief rabbi of another city. What city was that? Vienna. And Rabbi Noach was present when the Sma wrote the get for the 16-year-old husband, supervised the get. So you see that when the controversy exploded, it did take place in Vienna, but it really involved three great rabbanim from Lvov, all three preeminent figures, with one of them vituperatively but substantively attacking the other two. Well, not the other two, the other one. You see, the Chachmas Menoch died very shortly after the divorce. So we now begin to discern a clear picture of the facts. Husband and wife were the teenage children of two very rich Lvov families. In the case of the young wife, her family was actually a mercantile Prague family from Prague, which conducted business and owned property in Lvov as well as elsewhere. They seem to have resided in Lvov as well as in Prague and Vienna. Rabbi Yeshua Kohn's son, the son of the Sma, later married the sister Batsheva. So the 16-year-old husband was a nephew of the Maram Lublin, and the family of the wife was in very, very close terms with the Sma. So it's not just, you know, what's an objective situation. Since the male relative of the Maram Lublin, that's our young 16-year-old husband, had been wronged by a conspiracy, as he saw it anyway, involving collusion between Batsheva's family and their friend Rabbi Kohn, Reb Meir flew into a rage to Maram Lublin, and by word and writing denounced the entire affair as sordid and corrupt. Most importantly, he denounced the get as invalid. The Maram Lublin asserted that Batsheva was still married to Yitzhak, with all the consequences that flowed from that. Presumably, if there were to be any new negotiations between Batsheva's family and Yitzhak, Reb Meir himself would participate and see to it that Yitzhak was not taken advantage of. By the way, I'm being mild over here. If you look at Myron Blumen, he said they tried to poison the girl's friend, tried to poison the husband. It's really something. Now, charges of corruption, unethical behavior were just words. And coming from somebody like a mayor of Lublin, who is known for vituperative denunciations of others, were probably taken as rhetorical. On the other hand, declaring a get to be invalid was a serious matter indeed, one that cannot be ignored. So this, what I'm describing to you now, reading to you, is called the Haget Mivina, the controversy about the get from Vienna. Halachic culture has always regarded the status of a nacious ish as most consequential, not easily altered. Even if it's a suffix, even if there's doubt cast upon the validity of get, so the woman's a suffigacious ish, and she may not remarry until her status is clarified, which usually means you need another get, just to make sure. If a great rabbi like Myron Lublin challenged the validity of a get, and if other important scholars would agree with Myron Lublin, and some did, then he would have won de facto, do you follow? Because then she couldn't get married without a second get, and then they start the negotiations for money all over again, which would reverse the balance of power in favor of Yitzhak, the 16-year-old husband. So the main issue was whether or not the get was not valid. Why should it not be valid? Rabbi Cohen followed proper procedure. Perhaps Bathsheba's relatives had taken advantage of Yitzhak, perhaps not. What does that have to do with the legal question whether the get was chal, whether the get was valid? To make such an argument was not easy and would require a lot of fine reasoning and perhaps strained argumentation. But Myron Lublin was the man to do it. A foremost scholar in both law and theory, he composed a very long tshuva in which he built a case, as paragraph after paragraph, that Bathsheba was not divorced from Yitzhak. Essentially, he presented every possible argument for the get's validity and demolished them one by one. Although densely intellectual, the tshuva is not boring because it's thoroughly interspersed with disparaging ad hominem remarks. You never fall asleep reading a tshuva from the Myron Lublin. Obviously, this is not the place to rehearse all the arguments. Remember, I gave this, it's also not in a podcast. I'll just present the basic arguments and then the ones that specifically relate to the cherem. On the face of it, the execution of the get was performed in accordance with the instructions of Yechiel of Paris. The young husband was told to agree to divorce his wife and to hinder the get unconditionably, and they said, Al tidag, ki zeh lo yazig lach. Don't worry, this won't hurt you. You won't suffer from this. Obviously, they said in Yiddish. The husband did so. It is important to note that Bathsheba herself, under advice of astute counsel, said nothing during the entire affair. Negotiations on her behalf were conducted by her mother. As for the husband's wish that Bathsheba stay with him if he recovered, this was stated in a separate document that Bathsheba's family signed, where they promised, mind you, they promised that she would remarry him if she recovered, and they agreed to penalties for noncompliance. The silence on Bathsheba's part indicates she was the beneficiary of sound legal advice, probably from the wise and astute Sma, Rishu Akon. There are cases in the Talmud where a dying, sobbing husband was tearfully assured by his wife that whom he's divorcing to save her from becoming an aguna, and the wife says, Amaikom is nachas, ikam is didana. You know, what are you worried about? If you get better, here I am. I'll remarry you. There's a whole discussion in the Gemara. Those who know Gittin know this. The discussion whether these words of the husband constitute a commitment or condition of divorce or not. Maybe she's just saying it. In the case of Vienna, Bathsheba had said nothing. On the other hand, Bathsheba did silently perform a Kinyan Sutter, where she raised a handkerchief in a well-known ceremony of commitment, and she did so substitute a cherem of kehillas if she didn't carry her promise. Now, Rabbi Cohn argued that since the get was unconditional, whatever else happened between the couple or between the parties was not relevant to the validity of the get. She's divorced, period. The money fights is a separate issue. The whole point of following the procedure of Rabbi Chil of Paris was to validate the get and consign everything else to lawsuits and Beis Din. In court, it could be decided who was entitled to what property, whether or not Bathsheba was in violation of Cherem Kehillos and things like that. If she lost there, she would have to make amends by financially or by penance or whatever was required to have the cherem lifted. But she would not still be married to Yitzhak. That's my point. In fact, Bathsheba had already married or was engaged to another man, as I told you before. That's one side. By contrast, the Myron Lublin argued that in the case of a get shchimera, the divorce is only meant to take place if the husband dies of his illness. The point of this type of get was it was to take place retroactively so that the wife was a divorcee but not a widow. As a divorcee, she was spared the aguna problems associated with even a chalitza. But the divorce was never meant, he said, to take effect if the husband recovered. Now this is a chiddush. It's a novel legal theory. It seems it had never been tested before until this controversy of the Vienna get. At least there's no record of such a case which highlighted such a legal theory in previous halachic literature. The ordinary understanding of get shchimra is it's a full get. But a mayor of Lublin, Keen Talmudis, made a full brief laying out the case for his interpretation. In addition, he argued that the particular case, the husband had been solemnly promised by Bathsheba's family that she would remarry him, and Bathsheba herself had committed to do so with a cherem, and so the cherem was, in his opinion, to strengthen and not replace the husband's assurance that he would not lose his wife. To strengthen it. In other words, he held his there. For his part, the Sma, Rabbi Kohn, an equally preeminent Talmudist, argued the other side of the law in a long tshuva of his own. More importantly, Rabbi Kohn challenged Rabbi Meir's version of the facts. Rabbi Kohn's version has Bathsheba's side behaving in an entirely honorable and ethical manner, with the husband initiating the ultimate waiver of the cherem. The arguments are many, long, and detailed. I only want to call attention to the role cherem plays in this story. Remember, this was at a conference. One of the arguments advanced on behalf of the wife went like this. Yes, she promised under cherem that she would remarry him, but all that means is that if she didn't, she'll be subject to being under a cherem akehillas. Very well, she was willing to live under the stigma, but it didn't mean she's not divorced. She was a divorcee, and subject to cherem akehillas, big deal. There's nothing to do with her status as being free of her husband. Rav Meir strenuously objected to this, as we've seen, and said a cherem was not understood in that way. Rather, it's a way of assuring that he would not, under any circumstances, divorce her in a way that resulted in there being a divorce if he recovered. What we have over here is an argument over valence, the power of cherem akehillas in actual practice. The lawyers of Bathsheba are arguing that the cherem is serious, but not so serious that its violation was so unthinkable that it's another way of saying that if the husband recovered, she never intended to be divorced from him, regardless of his statement that the get was unconditional. Rather, a cherem is a promise, that's all. Non-fulfillment of a solemn promise is not model behavior. It's not the end of the world either. Like Donald Trump declaring Chapter 11 or instructing his attorneys to settle a suit, and you pay a penalty, and you pay the penalty, you move on to the next venture. A cherem, you know, is in the sense used over here, and the promise commitment is something serious, but not the end of the world. Okay? I just threw in historically, I think we're hearing the echoes of a class discourse. The discourse of an elite class, you know, the cherem can be undone, it's not permanent. I mean, if you're rich and powerful, you can get out of it, you know what I mean? It's not like the Kiel of Vienna, Lvov, or Prague, anywhere else is going to ostracize them or really take the richest family in town and put them in cherem. I mean, you know, not really. You know, not in Baltimore or anywhere else. No individual community went ahead and pronounced anything against her family, Lamaisa. Although the stigma was real, her family, by astute maneuvering, was able to get Yitzhak to waive all of his claims, right? And didn't we see that in the end? So there was no cherem to worry about because the story, as I told you, was he signed away everything in the end. Now, not every family was so rich and powerful they could get the legal advice of the Sma, Mr. Chasha Mishpat, to extricate them from a cherem entanglement. But the wealthy family of Bathsheba could. As is true at all times, those who have access to top legal counsel are somewhat more equal in the law courts and in the Bati Din, I'm sorry to say. Perhaps not. As I indicated, the Maram Luma was no slouch, and he was second to none in his legal astuteness. His long chew is brief, forcefully argued, and his astute strategy seemed to be to raise enough dust to dirty the get. You see, as I indicated, in halachic culture, even if there's a suffix about the get, a doubt, that's enough to make the courts and the poskim nervous and get them to say, she needs another get just to be sure. Obviously, in a case like ours, this would either mean Bathsheba's remarriage to Yitzhak, despite her engagement to another guy, or a renegotiation, my friends, of the financial terms in a manner more suitable to the chassan side. As it happened, when the vituperative responsum, the tshuva of Maram Lubin, came out and circulated, the family of the Kala and Rabbi Kohn solicited tshuvas of their own from leading rabbinic scholars that would support their side, and hence we have the controversy of the Get Mivino. The first rabbi they approached was the famous 81-year-old Lavush, a Mordechai Yaffe Apozin, the senior Talmud Chacham in Poland, To their shock, the Levush sided with the Maram Lublin and said she's not divorced. Now, to have two senior scholars argue that she was not divorced, and the Levush wasn't considered, you know, a wild person, as Maram Lublin was, this did not help the Basheva's side. Subsequently, Disma was able to secure numerous tshuvas supporting his side and confirming that Basheva was indeed divorced. These tshuvas from people like the Bach, the Marsha, the Masses Binyamin became classics of the response literature and assured that in terms of halachic theory, the opinion of the Sma would become the consensus opinion in later halachic literature and practice. The Vad Arba Rotzes, the main body in Poland, in 1611, that year, and the following year, declared for the Sma. They said Batsheva was divorced. Mayor, the Maram Lublin, was publicly censured. See that? Publicly censured. When he returned to Lvov, he was the object of hatred by the students of the Sma's yeshiva, and who within a year had him kicked out of town. He ended his days in 1616, 5 years later, in Lublin, for where he had been driven out a quarter century earlier. Rav Meir's arguments would be rejected by most, but not all. Most significantly for our conference today, Rav Yona Navon of Yerushalayim, that's the Get Pashut, I think, concluded if a cherem was involved, then indeed the wife would be married if the husband recovered. If a kenas was involved, then the wife would be divorced, just subject to a penalty. So notice, he said, cherem, that language is very strong. Clearly, for this Sephardi dying in the 18th century, a cherem was sufficiently severe to be accorded the greatest weight. That's in the Get Mekusher. That's the safer. What this suggests in more sweet... I'll skip all that. So anyway, here, my friends, I've gone long enough. Who won? You know, in history, you want to know who won. And the answer is the Maram Lublin. As Rabbi Cohn grudgingly conceded, the arguments of the Maram Lublin and others carried sufficient weight to make a suffix hover over the divorce. In order to spare his daughter any taint that her second marriage may have been adulterous and that her grandchildren, might possibly have been tainted with Mamzeris, Batsheva's father secured a second get from Yitzhak. And you can be doggone sure, my friends, this time the chasson was accompanied by his uncle, the Maram Lublin, to ensure the property and interests of the 16-year-old boy were protected. Although Rabbi Cohn was at pains to stress that he, and not Rabbi Meir, was in the right, in practical terms, the attempt to gain unilateral advantage by one elite family over another was not successful. The two families were too well lawyered for that to happen. So in the end, each side could claim victory. One victory in principle, the other principle with interest. Okay? So, there's more to this. I'll just finish it off. What role had the cherem played in this outcome? Not much. At the end of the day, even if Batsheva had been deemed in violation of her cherem commitments, it would not have induced her family to renegotiate the terms of the financial agreement they had wheedled out of Yitzhak. At the most, it was an improper thing to do. In the words of one of the leading rabbis who sided with Batsheva, meaning even somebody said on her side, she said, this is from the Masses Binyamin, a famous posse. He said, I side with you, but you didn't do right. Haget get gomer v'gerushin gemurim. Himu teres l'chol olam heim yom usyichya. El she'ein nochun lasses kain. And they achem because I don't like what you did. In other words, ethically, it wasn't the way you handled with this chosin. Kam sheres yisrael lo yasa avu lo yidabra chosin yimotsi loshin taharmis. The pasuk says that Klal Yisrael, a frum Jew, doesn't act in an unethical manner. Ve'ein l'cho avulis ramos golo mizebefim. So that's somebody who sided with the Kala said that, okay? Now, unethical, yes. Illegal, no. And when it came to money and real estate, ethical considerations didn't seem to have prevailed. The Maram Lublin, my friends, understood this, so he did not pin his case on a violation of her cherem commitment per se. The stigma of being in violation of a cherem commitment would not have induced her family to negotiate. So the Maram Lublin, great Talmud Chacham that he was, ingeniously endeavored to connect the violation of to the validity of the get. He was vociferously criticized to his face, we're told, by the leading rabbonim at consecutive executive sessions of the Vada Barotzes for making this argument. They all screamed at him, and he just stood there, right? So I wish they had a movie for this, you know? He's just sitting there and taking it, say, Rav Meir stubbornly held his ground and thereby won his case. Even if in theory, his interpretation of the cherem that was part of the divorce procedure of Rabbi Yechiel of Paris was rejected by subsequent authorities. So, to use plain and simple English, I'll skip to the end. What the bottom line is who won. And Meir won because it's about money. That was what's going on over here. She got to get in the end, but she tried to take away all of his money. And she succeeded in the beginning. But they didn't know that he's like an uncle or something like this, his nephew of the Maram Lublin, and it pays to have a gadol on your side if you ever get involved in a choshen mishpat case. It's a little bit of a complicated case, but if you could follow what I said to you tonight, you have quite a story and you know the get of Vienna better than many other people out there. Good night.
For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidovidkatz.com.